Hello and welcome to the second episode of Pod Stallions. I'm Brian, and with me as always is Jason Lindsay.
Hello, everybody.
And we just wanted to say thank you to everyone who came around and checked out the first episode. I got some really lovely comments from people, even people who said, I don't know a thing about Doctor Who, but I wanted to check you guys out, and I look forward to future episodes. So thank you very much. I know some of you, Doctor Who might be German to you, as Jason said. It was really appreciated. And like we said, we're going to go from subject to subject each episode and add a little bit of topics that are a running theme that will be more relatable.
Yeah, same ditto for me. I mean, we've made it to episode two. That's always a good sign. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for tuning into the first one and giving such lovely feedback. I've read some of the comments, and we know we get a little carried away with the length and the subject matter and stuff, but it was just kind of – we were excited to be, you know, launching the thing, and you know, we promised the next ones will be a little tighter and more concise. But it sounds like you enjoyed the vibe and what you were hearing, and thanks for checking us out. And you know how much we love getting checked out.
Yes, and as an added bonus, I think it was smart of us to get the Who out of the way.
Yes,
because I think it would have propagated every podcast until we got it out of the way. So now we're kind of Who'd out.
Yeah, I think so. And it's just to go back to Who just for a second. Hmm. The cool thing about it, and was one of the first things you and I sort of connected on over the phone, was, you know, I've met people and connected with people having not known them before, and Doctor Who has come up, and you go, oh yeah, you too, and you kind of go, you know, play tennis and just kind of hit the ball back and forth in a conversation. But you are that guy that, and I am not saying that I am the Wikipedia of Doctor Who by any means, but you were that guy that just about everything I threw to you, every reference, you got and understood it. So I thought, well, this guy really paralleled my childhood in being into the same subject. And then it sort of sprung forth from there into all these different topics that we kind of, you know, both loved and grew up with. So in a way, Doctor Who was sort of a catalyst, our gateway drug to get into the other topics that we had in common.
That's really a great word, gateway drug, because today's episode is called, we're going to call it Toy Shop Days. And we're going to talk about toy collecting and how we got into it. And for me, Doctor Who was absolutely how I got into toy collecting.
Yeah.
I don't know, probably you too, right?
Well, I think it was the first thing that – you know, I have two older brothers, uh-huh. So I got things handed down to me, you know, certain toy lines that we had in the house, or, you know, Tonka trucks or whatever. My dad was a real fan and still is of older toys. And he would try to, you know, he turned me on to like the Buck Rogers strip. There was this collected hardback volume of loads of Buck Rogers strips. And within there in the back pages were photographs of some of the guns and holsters and helmets and, scooters and things like that that came out in the 30s and 40s, licensed merchandise for Buck Rogers, which I then became obsessed with. So he would take me to antique shops sometimes trying to track down items like this. So what I'm saying is, other than that, that was my first sort of understanding of a toy world before the stuff that I was into, that I was currently sort of getting. For Doctor Who, it must have been the first thing that made me understand there was a world that existed before my stuff, and certainly, you know, obviously in a different country, but existed that I was not going to find at the local store, you know, or the Target or whatever, that I was going to have to do some research on. So I would say it was the program that got me interested in, you know, got me interested in wanting merchandise, which then made me understand that there was another world out there of stuff that was older that people wanted to track down, you know?
Yeah, that's funny. Your dad, my dad was the opposite. In fact, he used to take me to toy shows and stuff and go, I used to pay 60 cents for those. What did you pay for that? You know, because he was in the toy industry.
Sure.
But the person that turned me on to toys was my – that gave me that idea there was a world out there was – up to, like five doors up the street was a German immigrant family called the Wagners, I think. Mm. And they had an older brother that every girl in the neighborhood loved. You know, he had one of those terrible mustaches and a hot car. But he was about 5 years older. He's a nice guy. Yeah. But going through, because he had a younger brother my age, we'd go through his stuff. And, you know, that's where I first discovered, like, Captain Action. What is this, you know? And in his room, he had the G.I. Joe space capsule.
Oh, wow.
And I'd never seen that. I mean, I was just too young to remember that. I think that's a 60s toy.
Yeah.
And it was like, there were G.I. Joes before I was born. You know, like that kind of like what else was – and he – you know, the Captain Action, I think he had a comic or an ad or something. And I remember thinking, I'll never see these toys. I'll never know what they look like.
Yeah.
And it kind of sparked me years later. But, you know, Doctor Who was my first mail order success and, you know, gave me a taste for vintage toys, the Talking Dalek, things like that. But then the Starlog, they had a – remember they used to have ads and send away for a list?
Oh, sure. But let's get right to Starlog then. So Starlog, as we mentioned in the previous episode, was kind of our, you know, IMDb, our Ain't It Cool News, our, you know, whatever you want to call it, for all the genre stuff. That was our source. And as I got more into the magazine and then discovered that there was a Doctor Who magazine as well, there's a parallel here, I would see, you know, photos of things in the Doctor Who magazine, photos of the Doctor Who toys. In Starlog, photos of conventions and toys at conventions or people making appearances. Far as I remember, anybody out there that's a native of the Twin Cities and a little older than me maybe can correct me on this, I have no recollection of sci-fi type conventions hitting the Twin Cities until I got a little bit older and understood that there were, you know, Doctor Who conventions were coming around. It was a world that it seemed to be really just sort of relegated to New York, you know, the coasts, basically. These big cities. I only thought that sci-fi conventions and Star Trek sort of conventions only hit the big cities like Los Angeles and New York, that they would never come to the Twin Cities. And that, in my mind, was the only way I was going to get into that room that had stuff that, you know, was vintage, for lack of a better word, or older, that you couldn't just get at stores. So I thought I'm never going to get – like I told you last episode, the first convention I went to was in 85 in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Never been anything in the Twin Cities. I mean, maybe there was and I just missed it, but I looked, believe me, I checked all the papers and Starlog and stuff like that. So the classified ads in Starlog were the next best thing. I thought, I'm never going to get to these conventions and get to be in a room with this stuff, but maybe some of these catalogs are going to help get me there or find some of this stuff. Is that sort of what happened with you? Because you did nothing locally?
Yeah, well, like I, you know, I started at like 14, 15, and I didn't know. Years later, I'd find out there were toy shows. You know, I started going to toy shows, and I did attend some sci-fi conventions, but they were all in Toronto, and I lived in the sticks, so yeah. It was all involving getting your parents, you know, to drive you somewhere, and that wasn't always easy. But ordering those lists, and the one I remember that stuck in my mind was a place in New Jersey called the Back Issue.
Okay.
And it was run by a guy by the name of I think his last name was Henkel. Nice guy, but I got that list, and there were things in there that just said, like, Palitoy Commander Koenig, $100. And there was no way I was getting $100. So what I did was I went to all the local variety stores, and I would – like, there would be Planet of the Apes model kits still there.
Okay.
And I would write down what the stores had, like Major Matt Mason Space Capsule and this one and Star Trek models here. And then I typed out the list. Like I spent like a day and a half, and then, you know, I called myself like Space – I can't remember what I called myself, but originally I had a name like Star Collectibles or something like that. And I sent this guy the list, and he just ignored it. And then I sent it again with the note, I'll do trades, and he phoned me.
Oh,
and,
my.
You know, and I was trying so hard to act mature.
Sure.
And, you know –
you're running a business.
Yes. Hello. Yes. My name is B. Heiler. I actually said that. I didn't say my full name. I was really pretentious. And he was just going, oh, hi. You know, he's probably in his 40s, you know. And we did.
Let me get Mr. Heiler for you on the phone.
And, you know, I was all abuzz about Space 1999 because I'd kind of drifted away from Doctor Who. We talked about that last time. And I was kind of getting nostalgic for stuff that I watched as a kid. And so this getting these unknown Space 1999 items were really interesting to me. And we did this trade. And for a cringe moment, too, at one point, I'm talking to the guy and my mom picks up the phone and goes, "Ooh. Hey, Brian, can you get your dad some ice cream?" and like hung up. And like the guy just, he's giggling at me, you know, like,
you're like, I must be getting another line coming in from down the street.
It's just a party line. Yes.
It happens sometimes. Yeah. Anyway, back to business.
Yes. Important business. And then I, you know, we did this trade, and the first thing he traded me for is he gave me $75 credit for the Planet of the Apes Soldier and Stallion model kit, which was apparently really rare, and it was at my local variety store, which I paid like $5. And the first thing I got was Captain Xantor, the Christopher Lee character on Space 1999.
Oh, yeah.
And I got the doll. It was, I remember the day. The box was on my front step. I opened it up, looked at it, and it was a Mego. And it blew my mind in the way that, like, they made Migos of Space 1999.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't understand, but I loved Migos so much as a kid that it just set me off into what else did they make? What else is available? And I was still operating under this kind of almost beard that I was a sci-fi collector, not a toy collector.
Right.
You know, like, I would run in at thrift shops and stuff. I'd run into Big Jim Toys and be like, that's baby stuff. And I started doing this dealing all the time, and I found a business card that said Mego. And it was a guy who was connected to the Mego warehouse. My dad had taken me there, but somebody had kind of picked it clean. You know, I got Kirks and Spocks and Klingons, but there was a guy out there who had all the inventory, and I found him.
Wow.
And he was this 60-something fella by the name of Joe. And I can't believe my parents let me do this, but this guy took me under his wing and let me do yard sales with him every Saturday. So can you imagine, you've got a 15-year-old kid.
Yeah.
And this elder New York gentleman who's got a stogie in his mouth picks him up every Saturday and goes yard sailing with him.
And you are a handsome 15-year-old. That's not.
Well, yeah, not, but you know, my dad once asked me, is this on the up and up?
Oh, wow.
And I said, oh, absolutely, yes. And, you know, I think that Joe came to pick me up with a shirt that had a teddy bear on it that day.
Ooh.
Which was like, ooh, yeah, that was a bad shirt to wear today.
Joe, do me a favor. Leave the teddy bear shirt at home.
Yeah. Lovely man. I haven't spoken to him in years, but that's not for lack of trying. Wonderful person. And I owe a lot to that guy. He was fantastic.
Well, he was like your Obi-Wan.
He was a mentor. And, you know, he was a collector, and he was just he just gave unto himself.
Well, let me jump in real quick, because you said something I think is important. So you open this package, and you see this action figure, and you see the word Mego, and you just about wet your pants. But that's what's going on at this point. Like, besides the things like the Buck Rogers book I just mentioned that might have some photos in the back, you know, Starlog, if you recall, you remember those Starlog books that they started to publish in the mid-70s, late 70s?
I know exactly where you're going.
They had like a TV one or a sci-fi TV one. They had a
one about weaponry, one about weaponry, spaceships.
Yep, and one of them was about toys. And it was actually, I believe, written / edited by Steve Sansweet.
It may have been. I think I actually found a download of it recently.
Well, I have a hard copy of it. So it's about 1977, 78. Star Wars stuff is in there. They have a couple of Doctor Who pieces, which I couldn't believe. But, I mean, other than that, there really wasn't any kind of – unless I'm crazy, there really weren't any kind of guidebooks out there that you could, you know, go just grab off the shelf and go, wait a minute, okay, so they made this for Space 1999. How many characters did they make? And you really were, unless you had someone like this Joe guy that you're talking about that you used to let touch your knee in the car when he, you know, took you out on
shopping. No, I can't. He's too nice a guy.
But, you know, unless you had someone like that really could explain it to you, there was no way to know what was out there. Just like you with the Rack Toys and finally writing the Rack Toy book because no one had done it, you're still discovering stuff because there really is no major, you know, guidebook that tells you all the Rack Toys that were made. Nobody really kept track of this stuff.
Yeah, you know what? You bring up a good point. I was so desperate for reference that I would buy old department store catalogs, which led into Platt's Dillions. But
oh, there you go.
Also, do you remember the book Fantastic Television? I think it was called Fantastic Television. It was like one of those books that talked about Star Trek and the Outer Limits and Space 1999. Boy, the guy hated Space 1999.
Okay.
But I think in the back of that book is a black and white photo of Star Trek merchandise. And the book was written around 76. So there was pictures of Mego Star Trek aliens and some I'd never seen.
Okay.
So I can remember using my parents' photocopier to blow that photo up. And it wasn't a very great photo.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a grainy picture of the Neptunian, which is one of the made-up Star Trek aliens. But I had no idea what that character was. And, I was sitting there like I was, doing the Zapruder footage or something, trying to figure out what this is.
Well, yeah, that's what – when we did come across something, I mean, I remember just those grainy shots in Doctor Who Monthly.
Oh, which, yeah.
Which was printed, besides the wraparound cover and the occasional insert, that magazine was like newspaper print. I mean, even Starlog was on better paper than Doctor Who Monthly. It was newspaper. So, the photos were all black and white. And if the shot was too dark, man, when it got reprinted and put in the magazine, you could barely make anything out. So I remember looking at these grainy black and white dark photos of some of the toys and merchandise, like the Dennis Fisher stuff. That's the first time I ever saw pictures of those figures. And again, this just to tell you how, I mean, we sound like old men here, but this is only because technology has jumped so high, so fast, even in the past, decade. Back then, I was aware there was some kind of merchandise guide in a particular issue of that magazine. I found out through someone else. I then found that issue in one of the UK catalogs that I would mail away for, found it, circled it, sent away for it, with the cash that I would do. I'd get an order together, send cash, and then, 10 weeks later, it would show up. So from the time I heard about it from this kid or whatever, to the time I got to look at the photo in this magazine was months, to get home, to open this thing up, to look at the magazine, to look at the photo, be aware that this thing existed, because other than that, there was no way to see this stuff or know that it was out there. It was no internet. There were no, fans, swapping photos of stuff. Did you ever do, this will segue into something else too, any kind of like pen pal sort of things from the UK? Because I had a couple of people that became sort of frequent traders that I would trade with when I was, like 12, 13 years old, getting American items that they couldn't get a hold of to swap for stuff they had.
UK and Australia. I used to do a lot of dealing with a guy in Australia and mostly the States. And, most of these guys were like baby boomers. Mm-hmm. So I was just this kid, on the other end. And, Mego was junk to a lot of these guys. They wanted Captain Action I found some Captain Action and I want to trade it for Mego, that kind of stuff. But yeah, abroad especially, I think, especially when I got Space 1999 was related to Gerry Anderson, of course.
Uh-huh.
We'll have to do a whole show on that. But
sorry to jump in. Did you know that? Were you aware that this was the same guy that did the Thunderbirds? And
yeah, I was because of Starlog. And and we'll have to do a Starlog show too.
Absolutely.
So those guys that were really well connected. What were they called? Fanderson. And there was like stores dedicated to Gerry Anderson, and to their credit, they were all really communicative and nice people. So, I was constant. I was so addicted to getting parcels. I would do lots of trades and buy things.
Me too.
And I have a diary. I found it, my 1987 diary. Maybe I'll scan a picture of it. It might not be visually stimulating. Where I would, if I sent away for Amigo Romulan, I would write Romulan sent. And then I would put an R in the date, and then like 2 weeks later, if I And it, like, I was going through it, and I was like, wow, it usually took 6 to 8 weeks to
Oh,
get
yeah.
something back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, like, absolutely. We're so spoiled that, you know, I can PayPal somebody in England on a Monday and hold the toy on a Friday.
Yeah. And ironically, you know, knock on wood, I don't recall ever having a package go missing. Like, everything I sent away for, I got. I don't recall anybody trying to mess with me or not send me the stuff that I lost
a Captain Action Spider-Man mask. It got ripped right out of the package.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if it was malicious, but that was the only thing. And that was crushing, you know. But,
wow.
Yeah.
So now you're discovering the classifieds and the back of Starlog were both probably at the same time, getting these catalogs, circling stuff we were looking for, you know. I mean, to be honest, because of everything else I could sort of get in stores, so really the only thing that I was kind of keen to get a hold of, merchandise-wise, that I couldn't just find at the local, you know, toy store, was Doctor Who stuff. But at the same time, there was very little that I was able to find in catalogs that was toy-related.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the stuff I was finding were magazines, books, annuals, you know, that sort of thing. And that's the bulk of what I collected. One day, boy, this is just coming back to me now. This is really bizarre. One day, I'm in a little town called Stillwater in Minnesota, which, you know, mom and dad would, you know, put me in the car maybe sometimes with a friend or two, or just the three of us. Early 80s, and we'd take a Sunday and go up to Stillwater. You know, it was a beautiful little area, lots of rocks and, you know, little waterfalls and things. And it was this great little town that there were these little unique shops, places to go for lunch and so on. And I remember there being some kind of a toy store that I would pop my head into sometimes, and a bookstore, which was, I think, some current and used books. And not, again, having ever had a reference for this, never having seen this before, at this stage in my life with Doctor Who, I'm collecting the paperbacks, the Target novelizations and paperbacks, and whatever sort of new stuff was coming out. And I walk in the door and I see a hardcover Doctor Who, the original logo, in an exciting adventure with the Daleks, with a drawing of William Hartnell on the cover. And it's written by David Whittaker. And it's one of the first three hardbacks that came out by, was it W.H. Allen? Was that originally?
I remember that, yeah. And I think Crusaders was one of them too, right?
That's right. And it was I think the imprint was 64, 65 maybe or something. Now, what the hell this British book was doing in a used bookshop in Stillwater, I will never figure out. But it was like $8, whatever it was. I grabbed it right off the shelf. I remember my mother, to this day, can talk about it and go, how did you have any idea what that was? I grabbed it, bought it. So that was like my first sort of vintage piece, I think, that I found. But to find it in a store was just
weird. It's serendipitous.
Very weird, yeah. So we're both kind of, you know, collecting this stuff. But now we're getting into that area where, because we're gonna jump ahead a bit now, where things start to slow down, where you and I both kind of, you know, around the same time, you know, freshman year of high school, sophomore year sort of.
Well, no, I carried on right until I was right until about 18.
Okay.
And then, because I got into Comic Buyer's Guide, which was huge. Those little handwritten ads.
Okay.
And I would get Comic Buyer's Guide every week. And, you know, we'll get into it a little bit. But I was calling the world from my parents' phone. But we'll talk a little bit more about that. But, yeah, I quit. Toy Shop Magazine had been out for maybe a year, but I quit not because I got, you know, I got sick of toys. It's because I got, you know, my life, I think 1988, 1989, my life was pretty good. Mm-hmm. And, I just didn't have time for toy collecting. I had, you know, a busy social life. I had girlfriends. I had, terrible retail jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And my whole life was about, you know, who's going to call me next, or who, you know, mm-hmm. that. So it was just toys took a back seat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we moved at that point, and I put all my toys in storage.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I didn't even put them all out for a while. So it was sort of they were out of sight, out of mind.
For me, it was, you know, right around, you know, Return of the Jedi and that sort of shoe dropping.
Oh, where, you mean childhood toys?
No, I just mean that it was sort of, you know, all of it was combined. Where I was sort of getting into high school. I still watched certain things. I still watched Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. I still picked up the magazine, things like that. But as far as, you know, really moving forward on collecting new stuff or buying toys at all, I don't think that happened again until, you know, spring, summer of 89. And I can tell you exactly how it happened, too. Maybe 89 or 90. I think it was like 89. There was a shop in St. Paul. And Dan Wiesenmeyer is a guy that I talk to every now and then after all these years. He and another guy called Brian used to run this shop called Hot Comics and Collectibles in White Bear in St. Paul, the White Bear area. I forget the street. Maybe White Bear Avenue. Anyway, in the afternoons, one of the local stations would run the Adam West Batman series. Mm-hmm. And these guys made a commercial. This is a local sort of, you know, legend now what these guys did. They made a commercial for their shop, Hot Comics and Collectibles. I wrote the number down. I'd seen it a couple of times, and I was like, don't miss it. Oh, what was the number? Wrote it down, got a hold of them, and went into the shop. And this blew my mind. Because I went into this shop, and it was the first time that I was seeing everything in there. There were some comics in there, but all the toys in there were not the toys you could just walk into Children's Palace or Toys R Us and buy. They were all – I mean, they had all the Kenner Raiders of the Lost Ark Indiana Jones collection. They had Power of the Force Star Wars figures carded. A line that before I walked in the door, I was completely unaware of. I had no idea that in 84, 85, Power of the Force continued the Star Wars line.
Like, isn't that funny? Because I was the exact same way. They did what? Because I gave up after Jedi.
I bought so much stuff from those guys in the next couple of years. I mean, vintage stuff. It was the summer of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Batman, License to Kill. I mean, Bond was a big catalyst for me too. When The Living Daylights came out, the first Timothy Dalton film, summer of 87, it was the 25th anniversary of the series. And I will defend Dalton till I die as being, in my mind, the second best portrayal of Bond next to Connery. I mean, certainly the closest to the books. He came out of the gate running with Living Daylights, and it was such a shot in the arm. Much as I loved Roger Moore, I knew sitting in the theater that we were seeing something we hadn't seen in a long time, that somebody was taking Bond seriously. And that got me into the Bond merchandise, going, I want Bond again. I want all the Bond stuff I can get a hold of, what's coming out that's new, you know, how much older stuff can I get. So, and the same thing kicked off with Indiana Jones. Now, I had collected stuff as a kid. I had my Indiana Jones stuff as a kid, but now I wanted everything. I wanted it carded. I wanted the Temple of Doom figures that I never got. And most of this stuff I got through these guys. In fact, back to Power of the Force, I had no idea there was a Han Solo in carbonite figure. I thought that was the coolest action figure I had ever seen at that point. And I bought it off of those guys loose with the coin. So the figure and the case that went over it, the carbonite case, loose with the coin for $15.
Wow.
And that was hard for me to hand the money over the counter. Like $15 for an action figure in 1990. Was a king's ransom. I was going, what am I doing? But it was that time where, like, you know, I was still living at home. I had a couple of jobs. I always had cash and didn't really have much in the way of bills. So I had a lot of disposable income that I could, you know, futz around with. And that got everything started again, which, of course, then led to those guys turning me on to something called the toy shop paper. Which I was totally unaware of. How did you first discover that?
Well, like I said, I was really into Comic Buyer's Guide, which was a Krauss publication. And my mom used to hate it because I subscribed. And they would have these handwritten photocopied ads, right, that you would handwrite an ad and then you'd get a quarter page for – or not even – I think an eighth of a page for like $15.
Oh, Okay.
And my mom used to look at like look over my shoulder and go, some of these people need to go back to school because their handwriting was so bad. But you would see like these comic shops would do an ad and go, you know, Sharon, Mego, $20 and stuff like that. And that because Comic Buyer's Guide got so predominant at the time because it was during the black and white comics revival or I don't even know. I wasn't actually a comic reader.
It seemed like more independent stuff was hitting.
Yeah, there was so much demand that they spun off Comic Buyer's Guide to Toy Shop.
Okay.
And I got a call from a toy dealer I knew or a toy collector I knew in Maine who said, yeah, I got the first issue. And he was so into Toy Shop because remember when it first came out, you'd call people and they'd go, oh, sorry, that sold.
Yep.
This guy figured out that if he had a P.O. box, he would get his issue put in his P.O. box on Sunday night. And would drive to his P.O. box on Sunday night and sit there and call people. Like he was that psycho about Toy Shop.
So let's clue people in case they don't know what this is. Toy Shop was it monthly, Brian, or twice?
I thought at one time they were weekly or biweekly. But I think originally they were monthly.
See, I thought it was just monthly, but I finally discovered it. Barnes & Noble carried it, or some of the newsstands would sort of carry it. It was a larger than a magazine, you know, format. I don't know how long, 18 inches long, maybe 12 inches across, and it had a thicker paper wraparound cover, but the inside was all
newsprint.
And from cover to cover, it was ads from around the world for toys and collectibles. And this was an absolute revelation. This was what the internet became. This was, and it was important to get your issue early because all of this stuff, most of the stuff in these ads were one-offs. So if you didn't nab it right away or make the phone call, and some of the ads were auctions as well. Do you remember that? Where it's,
phone auctions, the world's biggest scam.
Oh my God.
I used to do phone auctions through Hakes that I knew were legitimate. But if you went to somebody smaller, and I think this company, do you remember these guys? They were called Two Guys.
Yeah, I remember that.
In 1994, I was broke, but they had a phone auction. It said no minimums, no reserves. And the thing they had was they had every Hasbro Super Joe character on the card.
Okay.
Which, you know, in 1994, I don't think anyone gave a rat's butt about Super Joe, but you never saw them. Yeah. And they kind of – I do collect them now. So I called the guy up, you know, and it was just calling a guy in his house.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, hey, I'd like to bid on your Super Joe Commander. And he's like – I said, how many bids are on there? He goes, oh, no one's bid on it. And I said, okay. And, like, you know, the minimum was like $10. Okay. And he goes, yeah, I want $200 for that. And I was like, oh. And I was like, okay, how much this – who's bid on this Big Jim? He's like, I don't got any bids on that. And it's like, you know, the last hours of this auction. And I went, okay. And then I was about to say something. He goes, yeah, I want $150 on that. So he had just decided that, you know, phone auction's over. Yeah. You can buy it.
You can buy it for this much. I'll take it.
And it was just like, oh. And I hung up on him because it just kind of it kind of ticked me off a little bit, actually.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I remember phone auctions. I don't miss those.
You know? No, I did all right with them. I mean, only a handful. Did sort of, you know, went through and I won, but I did okay. But it was opening up this door, and not always with photographs because the ads didn't always have photographs in them. But again, back to this not having a master book of what was out there and what any of this stuff was, it was starting to kind of bridge the gap a bit as to what got made, what's out there. It opened my eyes to loads of 60s. Toys that era of Bond, you know, the Thunderball era where everything was out there. Doctor Who. I mean, every now and then I would dip into Who again, but mainly it was Bond and Indiana Jones. And it got so crazy that I had one of the biggest Indiana Jones collections in the country. I mean, I had everything you could possibly imagine from all over the world, and mainly through Toy Shop and all these relationships that would start to grow and sort of become a regular through Toy Shop. And again, it was the age thing too. Like, you know, there were times my family had a restaurant an Italian restaurant called Gino's for 50 some years. We all worked there. It was my great grandmother, then my grandmother, then my father, me and my brothers. We all worked there. From I was bussing tables when I was, you know, 12 years old, when I probably shouldn't have been. So I always had cash, and then I was waiting tables. I waited tables for 7 years. I waited tables, you know, Thursday through Saturday nights. You know, I went to school. I had other jobs as well. So I was always kind of doing okay. But there were certain times where, you know, I became friends, for example, with these guys that still do stuff on eBay. They have their own thing called Spy Guys, G-U-I-S-E. One of the guys is a man named Lee Pfeiffer that I became pretty tight with, and he's a Bond expert. He's also a guy that writes loads of books, like the films of Harrison Ford, the films of Sean Connery. You know, he's one of those guys. He used to write for the New York Times. He became friendly with Cubby Broccoli because he responded so well to a review that Pfeiffer had written in a paper about License to Kill, and they became friendly. So I became friendly with Lee. The best times for him to talk were Friday, you know, nights. And he's in New Jersey, so I'm waiting tables on Friday nights, sneaking off to the second kitchen we had, making long distance calls to pick his brain about Bond or like what new stuff have you got in, whatever. And these bills would come in, you know.
Yeah.
And my father just hit the roof. Like, what are you doing on the phone? So there was lots of that going on too at home and other places I could make phone calls. I was, you know, running up the phone bills like mad. You have a crazy story about a phone bill, right? Like,
I think I got busted in 87, Christmas of 87, with a $338 phone bill. And I was working as a prep chef after school and on weekends. So I was pulling down, you know, a lean $80 a week. And it became where I was like, you know, a bit of a junkie. And I used to know that if I, on the day that Comic Buyer's Guide or Toy Shop would come home, I would have a good grace period of about 20 minutes where I could read the ads, call the store, order the stuff before my mom got home from work.
Oh my God.
And there was a story once where this guy had a whole bunch of Star Trek aliens and they were like $20, you know? So I grabbed them all. But the guy, it was like I had Mr. Tudball on the other end of the phone. Like, okay, your name is Brian. And I could hear the car.
Hurry up.
Yeah, it's like, please stop. Please stop. And he got me busted. And I was like, basically, I was like banned from using the phone. Because I did pay off the bill, by the way.
But, you know, you make me think of something. I have a great story that's kind of related, but not really. It's about 79, maybe 1980, and egged on by the kid up the street who I was chummy with. He was like 2 years older than me. His name was Mark Pakulski. Because he was 2 years older than me, he always had stuff that I didn't have. Mm-hmm. Like, just he had a lot of the Planet of the Apes and Space 1999 stuff that I didn't have because it just missed me by a year or so, and he was a little bit older. But he knew toys, man. He really knew where to get stuff. And I mean, he told me that you could find Star Wars figures at like Hardware Hank, that even some of the stores were carrying it. So I don't know how I put this bug in the kid's ear that I was desperate to get the 12-inch version of Han Solo, which you couldn't find anywhere. Are you kidding me? And I spent a good hour on the phone. I mean, I'm like 9 years old, 9 or 10 years old, calling everywhere in the Twin Cities through the phone book, trying to find a 12-inch Han Solo somewhere. And I eventually start branching out into long distance kind of areas. And I then called my mom. I'll never forget. I called my mom at work and she thought it was an emergency. Like, why is he calling me at work in the middle of the day? And told her that, you know, everything's cool. Just relax, mom. It's no big deal. But listen, I found this Han Solo 12-inch figure from Star Wars, but it's in like Duluth or something. And she was furious that I was even making these calls. But even then, I was trying to find stuff that I couldn't just find in the stores, which I find kind of hilarious.
There's a huge allure to that. Yeah, I was the same way as a kid. There was something about that. The hunt, I guess.
And it is. It's kind of like the same thing with you go, oh, yeah, we should wrap it up. Wait a second. Wait. There's one more store.
Yep.
Let's just try the one more store because maybe it'll be there. Mm-hmm. Or just try that one more phone call. You know, it doesn't exist as much now. I mean, look, before we even get to it, the internet is an amazing tool, obviously. In the world of collecting, it has changed everything. Everything has changed. You know, all the toy shop, those sorts of things don't even exist. So everything's sort of at your fingertips, and there still is a hunt, and there still is, you better get on it quickly before someone else gets it or whatever. And you know, because of the internet, if you even had an inkling that something existed in the back of your brain, 9 times out of 10, within a few minutes, you can find proof on the internet that it did exist. And
it's an embarrassment of riches.
It's an embarrassment of riches. But there is a certain amount of fun that kind of has been taken away. That was there with the sort of stuff that we're talking about, this adventuring of, you know, trying to find this stuff. And this was also a time where, you know, I eventually sold all my stuff, all the Indiana Jones and all the Bond stuff. And I thought, well, someday I'll get it back here and there. And every now and then I'll pick something up that I've always kind of pined for since, you know, my early 20s or something. But if I were to go back now and try to get all the stuff I had, all the Bond stuff that I got, it would be 4 or 5 times what I paid for it. And also the trading that I was able to do, which leads me to another guy that became a really good friend, who I haven't spoken to in 100 years. Maybe you can even find him, Andy Foley, yeah, in the UK, and lived in Surrey, and he had a
shop, wasn't it,
called TV Toy Zone. And he would send me these catalogs with color. I still have some of them, the color photocopied pages of pictures of things, you know, the Lone Star Bond items and Corgi items, and just things that I never, ever, ever had seen before. And we would trade stuff. And for example, like when Dick Tracy came out, he had a hard time getting hold of a lot of those figures. I mean, they didn't just show up in the UK, and he had people clamoring for them. So I would round up all the Dick Tracy figures, send him a big box, which would cost me $30 or $40 to send him. And then I'd have all this credit with him. And he would, you know, track a lot of stuff down for me that I would never have been able to get otherwise, you know, bond wise.
Regional trading was great for me too, because I think in 87 or 80, maybe 86 or 87, we had a chain. We still have a chain called Canadian Tire. Okay. And they're a unique branded store that, I don't think you have anything in the States quite like it. It's like automotive and housewares. And okay, every Christmas they'd have a toy section. But what would happen is at the end of Christmas, they just pack it all up and send it back to the warehouse.
Okay.
So the beauty of it was that you'd see the same toys for 3-4 years.
Hmm.
So I think in 86 or 87, every Canadian Tire had a special on, and especially at Christmas Eve, they would start blowing this stuff out. Okay. Third series superpowers figures.
Oh, wow.
So Shazam, Mr. Miracle, carded Steppenwolf, which I think was exclusive to Canada, if I'm not mistaken. Tyr, you know, those guys. And I think they were a buck or two. And every toy dealer that I knew in the States loved third series superpowers. So I was going around, and by the way, I was taking the bus, and buying these things, running into my friends at malls who'd be like, what are you doing? You know? But
so you were a bit of a dealer.
I was a total dealer, and I actually, and I'll scan this up, but I actually found my one of my lists. This is probably from 1986.
Wow.
You want to hear some prices?
Sure, I'd love to.
Okay. Some of these are really sad. Some of these are great. Original mailer box Buck Rogers set with Buck, Wilma, Dr. Huer, and Twicky. So it's like the Sears mailer box. $10.
Oh, wow.
Mint in box, Buck Rogers Land Rover, $15.
Wow.
Let's see. Captain Scarlet SPV vehicle by Dinky. Mint in box, $100. Okay, that's probably...
That's a little steep.
It's a little steep. Ed Strucker's car from UFO. Mint in box, $30.
Jeez.
G.I. Joe, I've got, have I got anything? Yes. Mint in box, high voltage escape, $20.
Jeez.
Atomic Man, secret mounted playset, $40, but mint in box. Mego, 8-inch action figures, mint on card, Planet of the Apes, all $20. Cornelius, Zira, Dr. Zaius, Soldier Ape. Oh, I want $40 for Alan Verdon. because he's well, I don't know if he's a rare one. let's see. Man from Uncle Husky Extra Car, mint on card, has figures of Napoleon and Ilya, $20.
Jeez.
And, oh, this one's the one that made me cry. There's a Blake 7 Liberator on the card for $10. But Micronauts Monsters, 3-inch action figures by Mego, each come in beautifully illustrated boxes. I think I meant cards. $6 each.
Oh, my God. Like that dream that all the toy people have, like that they wake up from, like if I could just go back to that shop just for a day that I had stuff that I loved and get them, you know, for those prices.
I must have paid like a dollar for those Micronauts.
But see, this was a thing that started to happen when I sort of got back into things. You know, I understood that there was a world of this vintage world that was alive and well, and people. It was right on the cusp there. You know, it was right on that cusp where people were starting to – this was still a year or two off from people thinking that the item that's in the store right now is somehow going to be rare. Like right before the comic book thing that killed comics for a while where there were six yeah. different foil covers and everything. This is just before then. So I was able to get all the Kenner Indiana Jones stuff at a reasonable price. I was able to get Marion on the card in 1990 or whatever it was for like $50.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I remember too, in toy collectors at that time, there was also a certain element that would say, what are we going to do? Take toys away from kids at Toys R Us? You know, there were actually people I knew that thought it was ridiculous to collect modern action figures.
Yeah. It was, if you got it on the ground level, you know, you were able to walk away with some really good stuff. So
what toy line do you think changed that perspective?
You mean that people were looking at the stuff in the stores going, ooh, I better get, you know, two of these kind of thing?
Yeah, because I have a theory and I just wondered if it was close to yours.
Gosh. Well, the first thing that springs to mind, and I don't know if this is how accurate this is, but it may be there may be an element there. The first thing that springs to mind is when Playmates got the Star Trek license for Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yeah.
And this was still a ways off before they did anything with the classic show. But they did this thing on their packaging where they said, you know, each figure is individually numbered. And, you know, this wave that's coming out and the next is this. And exclusives started to kind of happen here and there. The fact that a toy company was already being aware, hyper aware, that there was a collectability out there for stuff. That was a signpost to me that something was going to happen to toys that happened to comic books, where they were going to start to see the value in making rare items and making people hunt for things and so on. So right around the early 90s, maybe, but that's the first thing that springs to mind. I don't think that was a catalyst, but it certainly, I was certainly aware of it. It certainly, you know, hit me.
You know, it's funny you say that, because wrong toy company, right license. I maybe because I was hanging out with toy collectors in the late 80s. That Star Trek The Next Generation line by Galoob, I don't think any kid bought those.
I
think it was entirely bought by adult collectors.
Yep.
Because and I remember it. I remember having to run around with a friend of mine, probably Joe, and he would go let's look through all these and see if there's a blue face Data.
Oh yeah.
And I'd be like, who gives a crap? Because I didn't, I never really cared for The Next Generation. But two, I didn't like, you know, these are new toys. What are you doing? And, that was the first one I noticed that people were doing that with. Dick Tracy, the blank, was a collector phenomenon. I realized that people were just buying Dick Tracy to collect them.
Yes.
And to a little bit, I think Superpowers too, but
the Dick Tracy blank, for those that don't know and they haven't seen the film, I don't want to ruin it for them, but it's there's something with that character that the mask comes off, there's something revealed. But that was a figure that was never available in America, that was only available in Canada, because they I believe Playmates wanted to hold off. Don't release it in the first wave so you don't ruin the surprise for anybody when the movie comes out.
Which is that it's the face of Wallace Shawn.
That's right. That's right. Wallace Shawn from Manhattan and Princess Bride.
Yes. He was the blank.
So they held off, but then I think what happened was the toys didn't do so hot, and so the blank sort of got thrown by the wayside and never got a release in America. But it did get a release in Canada. So that was a very hot figure. Even in like 1990, you know, when it came out, that was a figure that cost, I'm saying like 50, 60 bucks to try to...
You want to know why? I know the inside scoop on this.
Why?
One, the whoever was distributing the Playmates line, why they got it and America didn't is foreign distributors often pay by a letter of credit.
Okay.
So, you know, they'll order Wave 2. And then the American subsidiary, this happened a lot in the Mego days, goes, you know what, the Black Hole's not selling. We're not going to put any in the United States. But they have a purchase order that's paid for for Wave 2 from, you know, Grand Toys and the Italians. And they go, well, but we'll make it for you guys because they want to get paid.
Okay.
So that's why Canada and Italy and the UK sometimes – are these like bastions for things that we didn't, you know, you didn't get. I got them.
But no, you're right. The toy history is littered with all these, you know, these last sort of tail end characters in these action figure lines that didn't get the US release.
When the blank came out, the new Sears catalog came out. Sears was the only place that had them, I guess, because they had put it in their catalog. My friend, Brad, who ran a company called Amazing Third Planet, I think he still does, called up Sears and went, I'll take them. And I can't remember how many he took. It might have been 3,000.
Oh, my gosh.
Or 2,994. Like six people had ordered one.
Oh, my gosh.
And I think he actually said that somebody high up at Sears called him, like to make sure it wasn't fraud or something. And he goes, no, I'll take them. And he took, you know, cases of them. Like,
and then he was the guy that everybody had to go to.
He cornered the market. And he was also the guy that was in on the Mego warehouse find. That's what he did for a living. He would go and find warehouses of old movie posters and old toys. He was the toy hunter before it was a TV show. And yeah, he did that. He cornered the market on blanks.
Wow.
And yeah, he charged like 60 bucks a piece and got, you know, paid off I think he put the whole thing on his Amex, he told me. And paid off his Amex and, you know, kind of cornered the market on blanks.
People bought them.
People bought them left and right. And he came by at that the time he did that, I was at a toy show. And he came by the booth and said, hey, can I throw some blanks on here? And I said, do what you want. Those were gone.
You know? Yeah, people were desperate for that. It was one of those rare figures that everybody seemed to want. So now we're getting into this weird area in the early 90s where prices are being thrown around. People are paying for this stuff. It's getting, you know, the glory days like a year before where I could find stuff pretty easily and fairly cheaply. It's already starting to change. And at the same time, I start hearing about this catalog that's about to come out out of Chicago. And I remember ordering this thing. It was like 10 bucks or 20 bucks, which was a king's ransom to pay for a catalog back then. But it was delayed and delayed and delayed. And you kept wondering, why is this thing so delayed? I want this thing so badly. When is it going to come out? It finally comes out. It's called It's a Small World, Inc. And was it Irv Levarek? Was that who it was?
Israel Levick. He is the owner of Toy Tokyo. Lev.
Lev Levarek. So you would get this catalog. There were two sections to it. I'm holding it right now. The first section was black and white, which had all the details, all the written details. And then the back section of the black and white version had a chunk of, you know, 20 pages of black and white stuff. The other section was the color section of the catalog, a completely separate magazine that was a good 20 pages long. And if for those of you that don't know what this was and have never seen it, when you open it up from corner to corner, so from the top left corner to the bottom right corner, when you open a page spread, you know, top left corner of page one to the bottom right corner of page two, there are 92 items. A photograph of 92 different items are photographed. Each photograph is only about an inch and a half high. But it's in color. And those things we were just talking about where we would get a magazine or a thing and just stare at it until, you know, somehow the details, you know, were enmeshed in our brains. That's what this catalog was. To this day, this is still the single greatest catalog I have ever come across. This guy had stuff that I haven't seen since. He had stuff from Japan and, you know, Turkey and you name it, of every facet of the sci-fi fantasy comic book genre you could possibly think of. And I ordered loads of stuff off of this thing. And the catalog, on the when you open up the black and white section, there was a number that you your catalog number is 907. And it was a whole big list of ways that you had to, you know, instructions on how to order and how to, you know, get your items. And luckily, just about everything that I was after, that I wanted, and which was all Bond and Indiana Jones, he still had. But this is, in my mind, still the greatest toy catalog of vintage and semi-vintage toys I've ever come across. And you're familiar with it. You have it, right?
It was porn. And I have an interesting story because I got it because Lev and Mark Huckabone and Lenny Lee, who ran Lee's Action Figure News, they came to Toronto when it launched. And I got a copy. And sadly, you know, there was Mego stuff in there that I had never seen. And I was really focused on Mego. Yeah. And, you know, there was German two packs of the Western characters. And just, you know, I'm going to put up scans of this before when this episode launches so people can see it. But the sad part was the stuff I wanted, I was looking at the catalog and I was talking to Lev. Mark was whispering in my ears going, I got that already. Because when Lev was photographing the catalog, I guess Mark helped him.
Okay.
And, you know, Mark was – some of the really neat pieces, Mark's like, yeah, I'm buying this. I'm buying this. You know, okay. So it got published, and a lot of the stuff was in there. But the stuff I would have gravitated towards, unfortunately, it was also appealing to Mark, and he grabbed it all. Now,
but has anybody – sorry to interrupt, but has anyone ever – I mean, this is something you can't just get anymore. But it truly is the kind of thing that if it were somehow copied and made available, I think people would pay for this because it is an amazing reference, just filled with. I mean, I don't know where to begin with this. Between the stuff that we've already discussed and ancient Barbies and, you know, Japanese stuff and Soupy Sales Halloween costumes. I mean, everything you could imagine was in this thing. Has anyone ever, like, tried to put this up online?
I've scanned it a few times.
The whole thing?
I think I scanned the whole thing and put it on – not the whole thing. Maybe just the action figure parts on the Mego Museum forum.
Okay.
But never the whole thing. No, maybe I will. It's not that hard.
Okay.
And it's probably a really neat testament to something that, you know, a lot of us had never seen this stuff before. And, you know, I want to touch on a subject, too, because you did there. Remember prices back then? Like now, if I want to know, if I have a carded Mego Batman, mm-hmm. we have a thing on the Mego Museum called the going rate.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do is we track old eBay auctions.
Okay.
So it's kind of a running price guide. So I can see that, you know, in the last year, they've gone from $225 to $150, and you can kind of say, well, this is what I'm going to get for this piece.
Okay.
But back then, I can even remember there was a guy, I think he called himself It's a Small World or something like that. Don't quote me on that. I can't remember.
Okay.
He posted a catalog that had, like, every Mego at an – like, this is 1989. I remember getting this catalog. And I probably still have it somewhere, but it was like – you know, Kresge carded Wonder Woman, $800. Like prices you can sometimes not even realize now. You know, boxed Wayne Foundation, $700. Mm. You know, and some people I know say that guy ruined Mego collecting for like 2 years with that thing because people would get these price lists and go, oh, if he's asking that for that, I'm going to ask that for that. You know, the whole asking and getting was never as – nowadays, one of the great things about eBay is you can say, well, it's sold for that.
Right. Well, here's the double-edged sword about the It's a Small World catalogs. They opened up a doorway – talk about a gateway drug. I mean, this was like LSD. This stuff extraordinary. I mean, I spent weeks poring over this catalog, and just every day I would take it with me wherever I was working and prop it open, you know, wherever I was, and just drool over these photographs. His prices, now I can quote you some right here. There's a Lone Star James Bond set, which is it's a pretty difficult set to get. It's not the big Lone Star presentation set from 65, mm-hmm. but it's like the medium-sized one, you know, gun, silencer, handcuffs, holster, ID, you know, and the cardboard thing. Now, this is 1990. He's asking $650 for it. I saw a large presentation set, the next one up, missing a piece on eBay, and the buy it now, I think, was like $800 or $900. So he had a lot of – more stuff than anyone I'd ever seen. He also had pretty high prices. His stuff was not – I mean, the reason that he could do that was he was one of the few guys that had this much stuff and had some of these items. I mean, I found those Spanish – do you remember the Spanish Star Toys Indiana Jones figure that came out like in the late 80s?
Yeah, but I'd never heard of them until I saw them in the It's a Small World catalog.
Okay, so I had heard of them, but he took it a step further. And he had – they had also made like a survival kit, which was like a canteen and a camera and binoculars and whatever, with a crazy drawing of Harrison Ford on the cover holding all this stuff. And he had it for like $200. Well, I was never going to come across it again. So, you know, I had to get it from him and pay that, because I've never seen it since. So he was able to get away with it because he had this stuff that no one had. Back to your dealing sort of thing. One other thing that I came across that served me very well for a long time, and I don't know how I pulled this off. There was a GQ article or something that was pimping Dick Tracy when the movie came out. And in one of the photographs, it had a character, one of the models, wearing a watch. And it said, you know, Dick Tracy watch from, you know, World Blah Blah Organization, whatever the hell the watch company was. But it was supposed to be the replica from the film. I remember coming out of the film going, why has no one made a replica watch that talks? I mean, it's beautiful. Somebody should make that thing. Mm-hmm. Company did, but it was so complex they didn't get it out until like 6 months after the movie had already been out. But I hounded them from that ad I found in GQ forward. Long story short, I became chummy with the saleswoman. She was a bit odd, but she thought I was the coolest person, whatever. And I started, I don't know how I fudged my way into getting this wholesale, but I was getting these watches, which were, I believe wholesale was like $75, and they were supposed to retail for like $125 or something. I was getting these between like $25 and $50 a watch. Well, nobody had these things. They weren't in stores. They weren't mail order. Nobody could find them. It was a replica watch from the film in a box, and the top portion worked the clock on the watch, and the bottom portion was a gold mesh speaker. And when you pressed the button, it said, this is Dick Tracy, I'm on my way. So it was like a replica watch right from the movie. And the speaker was a little muffled, but people went nuts for these things. And I used those at like $75 to $100 a piece as trade. And I must have traded dozens and dozens of these watches with different companies and different catalogs and folks from the toy shop for almost a year, and would swap these watches for items that I wanted, for things that I wanted, like corgis and stuff.
That's great.
Yeah, I made a...
You had a, what is it called, a niche, sir.
I had a niche, and I made not paper money, but I made a fortune in trade off of this stuff. I don't know how I did it, but I did it. And I believe I traded It's a Small World, some of these watches, for some of this stuff. But his prices were pretty... They were pretty high. I mean, some of them are – but I mean, he had stuff in here that, like I said, to this day, I've never seen so much stuff in one place. Wouldn't you agree that it was just extraordinary?
Yeah, there really wasn't. I have a collection of catalogs, and that was one of the best that was ever made. And I think he knew it. And,
that's why it's wrong, right?
Yeah, it really was. And I don't think I absolutely doubt we'll ever see anything the like of it again. You know, there's been some great auction catalogs. But even then, it's not the same anymore.
No, yeah. No. But that to me is the sort of highlight of all the catalogs and all the stuff that's out there and all the sort of mail order stuff. And before long, you know, we had the internet. I remember that really started to get on my radar with the Star Wars prequels, when some of these toy sites started to put up photographs of the first action figures coming out for the prequels. And even before that, remember the ones that Kenner did when Kenner was still around, and they made those big bulky
Power of the Force, yeah.
Power of the Force, Han Solo, and
Steroid Luke and Anthony Nikitas Leia, yeah.
That was sort of the internet, and that became like, oh, you can order stuff through the internet, and you can, you know, and things started to kind of change. But yeah, my collections were really built up through the toy shop paper and these catalogs to find this stuff.
Did you ever put ads in Toy Shop?
I did some classifieds for things I was going to sell and a couple things I was looking for. I don't remember what I was looking for, but I remember never getting a response on the stuff I was looking for. And I think I sold two or three of the items that I put in there. I might have put the watches in there too. Yeah. And I'm okay with those, just selling them to make some bread to put back into toys.
Yeah, I did a lot of display advertising to make money. But I think the last ad I put in there might have been around 2002.
Oh my God, they were around?
Yeah, well, actually, yeah, I wrote for them.
You did?
Yeah, I wrote some articles around 2004. I think I became a freelance contributor. Oh.
Can you post those?
Yeah, I might be able to still I think I still have copies of them. But I was writing for them around that point, and they were really nice, really nice to me. I wrote a few articles about Mego and something else. I can't quite remember. At the time, I was doing a lot of freelance writing for publications, and I still do that, actually. And the pay's not bad, and it's kind of fun to see your stuff in print.
Yeah.
But they... That was around, I think I did that from 2004, 2005. Then they were obviously struggling, because I think they added the articles around the late 90s, you know, to make it more interesting and to pep up the book. And then they became a magazine for a while, and I subscribed to it. I may have actually been on the comp list, but I subscribed to it, and they just couldn't keep it going. And unfortunately, Krauss has fallen on hard times. They've canceled the Comic Buyer's Guide as well, which was just just really sad. I mean, those were great times. Just a short story of those ads. I kind of owe my marriage to Toy Shop Magazine, weirdly
what?
Enough. Yeah, and I'll make it very brief because it could be long. I put out an. I wanted to go to New Jersey with my friends to go to Chiller Theater in about 1992, I'd say.
Okay.
But I was living in a college dorm. I had no money, so I put a toy shop ad out selling the rest of my Mego collection that I had still left. And a guy by the name of Lou, who has a great podcast and we're still friends, bought my Fortress of Solitude playset for like $300. It came with all the figures.
Okay.
And it was enough money that I could, you know, pay for gas and cheap motels with, you know, four other people and drive to New Jersey and go to Chiller Theater. And when I was there, I bought a tape of Battle of the Planets, a VHS bootleg of G-Force, Gotcha Man, whatever you want to call it.
Okay.
I came home, popped it in, and just laid down. I had a broom closet of a room. So if I played anything on TV, everyone could hear it because, you know, the walls were thin. And this girl came into my dorm room and said, "Are you watching G-Force?" I said, "I am." And she said, "Can I watch it?" I married her. Not right there, but...
No, but because of G-Force.
Because I had that tape. So I couldn't have gone on the trip without the toy shop sales. And, you know, I could, if I didn't go on the trip, I wouldn't have bought the tape. And very possibly I would have made that connection with that girl I barely knew. You know,
wow.
I knew her in the elevator kind of thing.
So you see all that money spent and all those phone bills and all the time and energy spent on toys all paid off because you met the love of your life.
Right. And she thought it was neat.
And so, she thought it was neat. She didn't think you were some freakish hobbit that, you know, lived in a cave.
And I think the first couple of months into it, dating, I did a toy show. I was still trying to sell toys and wheel and deal. And I was getting back into it. It was kind of ramping up. And that was the weekend where I started really getting back into it. It was April of 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought her I gave her a gift. I don't think she still has it, but I bought her a carded Leia in the poncho from Endor as a present at that show.
So a one of the newer ones.
Well, like 83, yeah.
Oh, that's right. They made it.
Vintage Kenner. This was. And I mean, I think I paid $12 for it. Like they weren't, you know, they weren't really that. But I think I think a few years ago she was getting into something else and she said, "Do you mind if I sell this?"
I was like,
"Oh, no, I don't care." You know, like I really don't because it was just in a box. It was one of our that we kind of met because of Toy Shop Magazine in a roundabout way. So.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So, and you know what? That's when I started collecting again. I've been going through it. I have an eclectic mix of my old Toy Shop ads, and I wasn't a bad graphic designer back then, considering I was using a typewriter and a photocopier.
Nice. So
I might share some of that in the show credits. But you know, I think we should probably just round out and say, as much as I have a lot of nostalgia for those days. And the thing I miss about it is that never knowing what you're going to see or, you know, going to a toy show and not knowing that they made this or, you know, the discoveries are kind of out the window now.
There's very little surprise left. Even when you go to something as big as when I go to, you know, Comic-Con every year, I keep thinking I'm going to have that feeling one day that I had going to that convention in Philadelphia where I walked through the dealer's room. And everything I saw, I had either never seen before or I hadn't seen since I was a little kid. And there it was as a vintage item on a table. I never get that. Even at something as big as Comic-Con, you rarely come across stuff that really excites you.
And you know what's funny is, would I trade that feeling for the fact that I can click on eBay right now and there is a sea of Mego products being offered to me every hour?
Yeah.
And it's like, probably not. But so, and I also don't miss a dealer with his finger up his nose telling me that $300, take it or leave it. When are you going to see another one again? You know, I don't miss those days either.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, I agree. I mean, I say this over and over about you, but you, and it, part of all of us as collectors or whatever kind of stuff that we're into, a lot of it comes back to our childhoods and stuff that we dug in our formative years or what have you, but you spend a good chunk of your time in your pursuits, in your writings, in your cataloging of things, trying to recapture that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a bad thing because we know we can never go back. But, you know, you're one of those guys that's out there doing a good job of trying to signpost this stuff or cataloging it and saying, you know, remember that feeling when you walked in and saw this? Like every time you post, you just posted something on Plaid Stallions, which was – a Super 7 item.
Yeah.
For those of you who don't know, Brian is semi-obsessed with the Super 7, the Saturday morning cartoon from back in the day, where little to no merchandise was ever made for this. One thing I think you already have, which is a magnet or something?
That's actually from Space Sentinels. I have a watch, a Manta and Moray watch.
It's a rack toy. It's a you know, one of those fall apart in 10 minutes.
There's nothing but rack toys. That's the only people who ever invested in the characters. And DC slapped a heavy lawsuit on Filmation, so
that's right.
You'll never see anything for these shows.
That's right.
So yeah,
you came across something that you had never seen before. It has nothing to do with the show or the characters or anything. It's a typical rack toy. It's a plastic tool set, like saws and hammers.
Oh, yeah, it's junk and it's bizarre. But
it's got Super 7 on it.
It's got Isis and Merlin on it. And, yeah, I just had to have it.
It's like Christmas and Hanukkah and Festivus all wrapped up into one. So every now and then we can sort of get that feeling back, either – by capturing something that we never thought we'd get from when we were kids or just coming across something we didn't know existed. I found something recently from Italy, which was a tie-in to the Flash Gordon movie, a kid's Halloween costume of Prince Baron. Now, inside the box, this is from 1980. It's King Features 1980 for the movie. The costume itself couldn't look less like the costume that Prince Baron wore in the movie. It's like brown and red and weird.
It's kind of village people-y.
It's very weird, yeah. But the cover of the box is the advance Mylar movie poster of Flash and the Hawkmen attacking a ship that came out in the theaters, and that's the box. So it's an officially licensed item for the Flash Gordon movie, of which there are only a handful that exist. And I came across it just about a month ago, and it blew my mind that this thing was even out there, which means there's more. If they made a Baron, there's more characters. How hard? Yeah, I want to track it down. Maybe a different story, but they're out there. So every now and then we can still get a little bit of that feeling, with stuff that we come across. The internet still has some mysteries out there.
Yeah, and that's the best feeling in the world. And I'm currently with the Rack Toys. I'm still searching for something. I'm 50% sure that AHI made a series of parachute figures nobody's talked about yet.
Oh, yeah.
And,
a licensed thing, like a movie?
A licensed thing. I don't want to talk about it because I'm kind of on the lead. But
well, there you go. There's a couple of things that have happened to me in the past couple of years. The TARDIS tuner,
right,
that I finally got. The Kenny Everett Captain Kremen 12-inch bendy figure from the UK that I never thought I would see came to me after 30-some years. And aren't we still looking for the John Belushi parachute figure for 1941?
Yeah, and I know it exists because my pal Corey Lachat, who is on eBay by the name of Swank Cat, had one. And he provided the photo for Rack Toys that's in Rack Toys. So that was actually produced.
All right.
Bill Kowalski is the name of the character? Or
Kowalski sounds right. I don't know if it's Bill, but
yeah.
Kowalski sounds right. I have to have one. I've got to get.
Who doesn't want a John Belushi parachuting action figure?
From 1941. Come on.
Yeah.
The forgotten Spielberg movie. So we're still out there hunting. Well, this has been fun. Nice little journey down memory lane talking about all this stuff. Right. And there's much more we didn't even hit. Toys and stuff.
You know what? We could probably go through another episode, but let's regroup and do a Toy Shop Memories Part 2.
There you go. Nice.
Yeah, perfect. I wanted to do another segment that we were going to talk about, which is modern, but retro, things that we feel are retro that we're interested in that are out now.
Okay, yeah.
You know, we were talking a little bit about this, and I think this is kind of a fun segment. I do it every year as the Retro Awards, where I get excited about, like, you know, Kirk Hammett's book on vintage monster toys, or mm-hmm. An old movie getting re-released.
Mm-hmm.
And I have one this week that's kind of neat, but kind of obscure. I'm a huge fan of the Hammer horror films.
Oh, yeah.
And if anybody knows anything about them, they are a nightmare to license.
I've heard, yeah. I've
gotten one action figure of Christopher Lee as Dracula out of Product Enterprises, and I'm not sure how they did that.
Yeah.
So there isn't going to probably ever be a line of Hammer toys out there.
Right.
But there's a company, and I don't know exactly where they're based. I think it's Asia, where they do limited custom runs of action figures. They only do like 50 of them. You can only get them for a brief time. They're called Distinctive Dummies.
Yeah, I've seen them. They do like the Oliver Reed werewolf one. Werewolf at Midnight. What's the one called?
Oh my God.
Werewolves of London, right?
No. It's Curse of the Werewolf.
Curse of the Werewolf. Yeah. They do an Oliver Reed. They do Peter Cushing and different things. Mm. Yeah, I've seen those. They're wicked.
So they decided they were going to do Mego figures, and they're $75 a piece, and they're only doing 50 of each.
Okay.
And you know, I sat on the fence, but then I just, you know, I think India Pale Ales kind of softened my resolve one day.
It's always a good lubricant.
It is. And I picked up the Dracula and the Mummy they did.
Oh, cool.
And I got them in, and the card, they're Migos. They're really well done.
Mm-hmm.
Clothing is handmade. The card art is quasi-professional.
Okay.
Which I love because I collect vintage monster toys, and one of the things I love is, you know, you look at some of the packaging and you go, oh, are they got an 8-year-old to do this? But I mean, not to say this is crappy artwork, but it looks a little fan produced.
Right.
Which I love.
Which is charming. It can be very charming.
Yeah, it has a vintage vibe to it. Whether or not that's intentional, I don't know.
Okay.
But I think that it suits the style perfectly. A lot of people fail in trying to capture a retro vibe.
Right.
These look like action. The figures are too well detailed, but you wouldn't be, if you were in 1979 and you walked into a Ben Franklin and you saw these, your head might explode, but you would not be surprised to see them there. They would fit in.
Okay.
You know, because they are kind of, you know, Dracula's got blood coming off of his mouth and, you know, just a little bit of the kind of weird gore that attracts me to.
Yeah, the extra details that you
yeah.
love.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you're a fan of Azrak Hamway or Tom Lands or Lincoln Monsters, and of course of the Hammer horror films, I highly recommend these figures. They're really neat.
And can people just find them on eBay kind of thing?
Yeah, they're on eBay, and I think the website is distinctivedummies.com. I'm not 100% sure, but you'll find them, you know, if you're
well,
looking.
Very cool. Well, mine isn't nearly as cool, but it is just a quick little note. And actually, this kind of came up in a conversation between Jason Geyer and myself. And Jason Geyer is really one half of Action Gear Insight.
Yeah.
Put that together with Daniel Pickett. Mm-hmm. And we sort of came to this revelation at the same time, like we were just talking about something. There is a new line of toys that are out for yet another incarnation of the Spider-Man animated series called Ultimate Spider-Man.
Okay.
They've just hit the stores. There's like a, you know, a 10-inch talking Spider-Man. There are some vehicles. There's some, you know, kid-friendly ones where he's got like webs that come out of his – that are attached to his arms that are supposed to flick things around. There are, you know, 5-inch or so, 5-6-inch kind of more posable figures that aren't even on a bubble. It's a strange kind of packaging that they have. And then there are two action figures of Spider-Man. One is traditional, but very bright colors, very 70s kind of bright Spidey colors. The other one is like a stealth, you know, Spider-Man. Like it's like he's like blue, but he's sort of, you know, lucite kind of, you know, he's like see-through almost. Uh-huh. With the webbing and everything. He's got, you know, the 5 points of articulation, neck, shoulders, hips, and that's it. That's really, it comes with an accessory and like a little spider and that's it.
Uh-huh.
But if you look at it straight on, you look at the packaging and even the figure itself, the elbows are slightly bent and the knees are slightly bent. And the first time I saw this, the first thing that I thought of was, oh my God, this looks like the pocket superheroes from the 70s.
Oh, that's cool. So they're kind of functional.
It kind of looks, even the way it's sort of packaged and just the way the figure is sort of standing, like one hand I think is almost kind of a fist, the other one is more open. It's very reminiscent of the pocket heroes from the 70s.
Oh, I love those characters. I love the pocket heroes, so I might have to check those out.
Yeah, just go to your local store and check them out. It just kind of gave me a flash. Ooh, I wonder if they were thinking that when they put this together, because it's reminding me of that.
You know what? You want to hear something sad?
Sure, why not?
I have a 10-year-old. I have a 7-year-old. When we visit Toys R Us, I am the only person who goes in the action figure aisle. They're both into Lego and other things.
But is that sad? Is that really sad? Don't you know the old saying, you're only as old as you feel, and I hope you never lose that fascination. You know, if you become a hoarder and they find you, you know, they don't find you for 3 days because you're buried in toys, that's one thing. But if you've clearly managed to balance your life with a family and
No, I just don't have – I'm the only person interested in action figures in this house.
Well, next time I come visit, I'll go down the action figure aisle with you at Toys R Us.
Well, you saw Canadian Toys R Us firsthand.
I did. They had Alfreds. They had Batman, The Dark Knight Rises, Alfreds coming out the wazoo.
Yeah, see, I
made an army of Michael Caines.
I feel like the Indian crying when I go down that aisle because it's just – It's very sparse. We don't get half the lines. There's no Captain Action in Canada. There's no Biff Bang Pow stuff in Canada. It's
well, maybe in reference to the episode we just recorded, maybe we can do some trading.
Sure, absolutely.
I'll find you some U.S. stuff that you don't have, and you can get me all the Barba Papa stuff that I can eat.
Well, and I'll send you enough Michael Caines to choke a horse.
There you go.
All right.
I want a cane from every movie he's made.
Okay. We'll do a swarm right now. I'll glue little bees to an Alfred.
Yeah, we'll have to do a Michael Caine episode too.
Absolutely.
Well, this was fun. I hope you people have enjoyed round two. Let us know if we're doing it right or wrong, or maybe some stuff you'd like us to tackle.
Yeah, give us some show suggestions. We're open.
70s dirty magazines, how we hid them, where we found them.
I would like to do some research on that again.
Yes, we'll spend the next month doing research. But thanks for listening, those of you that are, and hope you dig this too.
Thanks a lot.